Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
An Alma woman will serve 5 years probation for her conviction in a fatal hit-and-run incident. The Erie County District Attorney's Office says 37-year-old Stephanie Kolatz was driving a minivan on Transit Road in Alma on the night of January 8th when the vehicle struck a male pedestrian who was later declared dead at the scene. Kolatz left the scene without reporting the incident to police and later pleaded guilty to the felony charge of leaving the scene of an incident resulting in death. The man killed in the crash has yet to be identified. Anyone with information on his identity is asked to contact the district attorney's office. The millions of dollars collected by New York State in legal settlements with large pharmaceutical companies may be helping to lower overdose deaths. That is the suggestion from Governor Kathy Hochul, who says the state has made available more than $335 million in opioid settlement dollars to help local communities contend with the overdose epidemic. According to Hochul, over a 12-month period, there has been a 9% decrease in overdose deaths in areas of New York State outside of New York City. The state has distributed more than 700,000 life-saving naloxone kits in the last 18 months. And an Olean, Maine man rather faces charges for allegedly bringing fentanyl into the Cattaraugus County Jail. Sheriff's deputies say 45-year-old Justin Spencer was arrested early Tuesday morning on the charge of promoting prison contraband in the first degree and criminal possession of a controlled substance in the seventh degree. Spencer was discovered to be in possession of the fentanyl while being held in the jail on unrelated charges. Local state legislators claim regional OTB executives are receiving excessively large and illegal severance packages. According to State Senator Sean Ryan and Assemblymember Monica Wallace, a law passed in 2019 restricts employee severance packages at public benefit corporations to 3 month salaries. The lawmakers say the agreements for three departing officers at Western Regional OTB have a value of more than $500,000. They are calling for investigations from the State Inspector General and Attorney General. An education advocacy group says urgent action is needed in classrooms to reverse the slide in reading proficiency among New York State students. The Ed Trust New York is calling on local school districts to implement evidence-based reading instruction in classrooms to reverse a troubling reality. Less than half of all students are proficient in reading, with scores declining from the 2022-2023 school year. Only 41% of eighth graders are achieving proficiency in math. And federal funds could provide a literacy boost for the Seneca Nation. Nation libraries will receive two grants totaling $44,175 through the Institute of Museum and Library Services. In a statement, Seneca Nation President Ricky Armstrong said the funds will, quote, expand opportunities for the Seneca people. That funding was announced by Western New York Congressman Nick Langworthy.
This WBFO Brief podcast is made possible by Canisius University, where high-flying grifts find a top-flight education. For the last 8 years, Canisius has been recognized on U.S. News' list of best colleges and universities. Learn more at canisius.edu.
Of course, if you haven't noticed, it is a presidential election year with all the political campaigning and conventions that go with it. But beyond the headlines, there are grassroots efforts to encourage people to get out and vote. WBFO's Holly Kirkpatrick learned how a collaborative of Buffalo organizations is leading a nonpartisan push to get voters out to the polls.
No problem. Thank you so much. Have a great day, okay?
Freshly trained volunteers are hitting the phones to remind people to vote in the general elections this November. But getting people to engage with the issue of voting can be tricky.
And she does not want to talk about it, so that's a really good.
Tyrell Ford knows why that might be.
Because we know that our community is turned off and has a distrust in the electoral process.
Ford is the executive director of Voice Buffalo, a nonprofit that focuses on racial justice. It's one of five organizations that are collaborating to mobilize low propensity voters in Buffalo. That's people who are registered to vote but don't use their vote in every election. Ford & Co. aim to take a face-to-face approach to get people to the polls.
Our total goal is 500 doors to be knocked down. In those 500 doors, we want to get folks to sign pledge cards.
The pledge cards are a little bigger than a regular postcard and are emblazoned with the date of Election Day, November 5th. Those who answer the door and say they intend to vote will be asked to voluntarily make a pledge to do so and to seal the deal by signing the card.
I love this initiative really because it is putting the power back into the voter.
Jasmine Westbrook works with the Healthcare Education Project, the lead organization for the nonpartisan initiative that includes Voice Buffalo, the Buffalo Urban League Young Professionals, Open Buffalo, and the New York Civic Engagement Table.
We're sending it back to the registered voter in mid-October, right before early voting starts, so people are reminded of the commitment that they made. So although it's August, they may forget our conversation, but when they get this postcard in the mail, it'll be a reminder.
Westbrook says low-propensity voters in the 14214 and 14215 zip codes are on their radar. Data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows the population in those two zip codes is mostly Black, Asian, or Hispanic. And the latest data indicates that registered Black, Asian, or Hispanic voters do not use their vote as much as registered white voters in New York State.
I've always lived on the east side of Buffalo. It's always been a low number of turnout, whether it's a local election, presidential, we usually have more, but it's still low compared to other parts of our area.
Figures from 2022 show that 79% of registered white voters in the state turned out to the polls, compared to 67% of registered Black voters, 64% of registered Hispanic voters, and 56% of registered Asian voters. Professor Connor Dowling of the University at Buffalo's Department of Political Science says that the group's door-to-door approach is the most likely to put a dent in these numbers and get voters to the ballot box.
The more personal the contact, the more effective it tends to be.
He says that generally speaking, low-propensity voters become so due to the sheer number of elections that take place in the United States, as well as a general lack of education and media coverage of elections other than the presidential race every 4 years. And there are often structural barriers that may deter people come election day.
Those are those things that different people face to different degrees in terms of just being able to get time off work or making sure they can just schedule their lives around voting, we might say.
And why is it important for campaigns, or maybe that's the wrong question, why is it important for campaigns or democracy for these voters to be mobilized?
So I think it's important on both counts, both for campaigns and for democracy. From a campaign's perspective, so say for a political campaign, like a partisan campaign, they're identifying low propensity voters who they think are also likely to vote for them, right, to support them as candidates. From a Democratic standpoint, small d Democratic, right, for democracy, and it's important because the more people that vote, the more people have a voice in the system. And I think from a general perspective, the better we feel about that the will of the people is who's electing people, and it's not just some small group of people who vote all the time.
And that's the motivation for Ford and the Collaborative's nonpartisan efforts.
Even though folks are distrusted in the process, it's still a process. Our ancestors fought so hard to have this process, and it's up to us to continue and teach our next generation that part of the process is sometimes you get what you want, sometimes you don't. But if you continue to stay out of the process, you lose your voice.
Holly Kirkpatrick, WBFO News.
Ontario's Premier Doug Ford's government has announced the closure of 10 supervised drug consumption sites across the province. Critics say the decision will have dire consequences and people will die. As correspondent Dan Karpinchuk reports, those same critics claim that the research suggests supervised sites are successful in reducing drug-related harms.
Premier Doug Ford was quick to defend the decision.
My heart goes out for these folks, but we're there to help them. We aren't there to give them safe injection sites and all the drugs that they need.
Ford's Health Minister Sylvia Jones announced the closures along with new rules. The 10 sites selected will have to shut down by the end of next March. Jones says neighborhoods with the consumption sites have experienced higher crime rates. She says the status quo is not working and the sites are just too big a safety risk. Instead, the province will spend $378 million on 19 new homelessness and addiction recovery treatment hubs, or heart hubs.
This opportunity for 19 heart hubs across Ontario to actually bring all of those experts together in those communities, whether they are experts in housing, in health, in mental health, in social services, bringing those agencies and communities, those experts together to make sure they can form the hubs and have that service into treatment, into recovery, is where we are focused.
But some, like Suzanne Obiora, the executive director of Ottawa's Somerset West Community Health Centre, aren't buying it. She says the decision will have dire consequences.
This will disproportionately affect members of our community who experience the greatest vulnerability and marginalization. This decision will not address the root cause of why people find themselves using substances. Rather, it will lend itself to people using alone, using unsafely, and putting them at increased risk of harm and death.
Others say the sites provide critical services to people who use drugs and have saved countless lives in Toronto and across the province. Bob Boyd is the CEO of Inner City Health in Ottawa.
This is exactly the opposite of what it is that we would like to see happening, where we would like to see these types of services available for people outside of the downtown core as well as in the downtown core.
In Toronto, Sandra Cahan-Chu is the co-executive director of the HIV Legal Network.
People are going to die. People are going to die. We're going to see more public drug consumption. We're going to see people getting infected with HIV and hepatitis C at a time when rates have actually leveled off in this country. But we're going to see rates go back up, because when you don't replace the needle and syringe programs, what do we have? We have treatment and hubs that you can't actually do harm reduction work.
But Premier Ford is defending his decision, and he didn't mince words when he was grilled by reporters a day after the announcement.
This was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's the worst thing that could ever happen to a community to have one of these safe injection sites in their neighborhood. The other problem I have was with the federal government. You know, safe supply. They get to go up there and get endless amounts of drugs. And guess what they do? They go out and they sell it. But as far as I'm concerned, the federal government's the biggest drug dealer in the entire country. It's unacceptable. It needs to stop.
However, many health experts insist that supervised drug consumption and harm reduction both work. And closing the sites will not stop people from using drugs. And it will also put more pressure on police, fire, and paramedics, as well as more crowded emergency rooms. For WBFO News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto on the Canadian
Beat. Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.